Warning. This episode is intended for adults and parents with young children. It contains discussions of subject matters that may be uncomfortable for some. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, I'm Joanne Pei, and welcome back to another episode of What Do I Know, where we don't know what we don't know yet. And today we're diving into a topic that I am a little uncomfortable with because it's got to do with our private parts and sexual health. We're happy to partner with MSD to push forward today's conversation. For over 130 years, MSD has developed important medicines and vaccines and aspires to be the premier research-intensive biopharmaceutical company in the world. My guest today is obstetrician and gynecologist Dr. Dash from Mount Elizabeth Novena Hospital, and she has been practicing for 15 years and is a huge advocate of holistic health. She's here today to talk to me about how we can take care of our feminine health, as well as address the scary C word, specifically cervical cancer, and how it's preventable if we take the right steps. Hi, Dr. Dash.
Hi, Joanne. Nice to be here.
I got that down. Yay!
And I was so professional that
yes, I know. And
yo, Joe, that was very professional. You got it.
Yes. Yeah, so, Dr. Dash, you've done many, many interviews, and I have to say that my perception of you has changed since we met.
Oh, no.
Because you always look so serious on those interviews.
I know, yeah.
But today,
yeah,
I think,
you know, focused eyes and everything,
and very professional as well. And of course, you are. I have to give some background about why I feel uncomfortable talking about my private parts. Because I think for you, because you are looking at it all the time.
All the time. It's what I do. Yeah.
Yeah. I always wonder, like, how does that feel?
It takes a while to get used to it, but then after a while, it's just second skin. We're quite happy with talking like that all the time.
Wow. Yeah. Like talking like what?
You know, like with my kids especially, it's like I use very regular medical terms with them. I don't say your pee-pees or your poo-poos and all that. I use actual terms like, you need to wash your vagina, girl, and all that stuff.
Right.
Yeah. So the thing is that they got so used to it that when they went to school and the teachers were describing things, they used the medical terms and they got in trouble. They got in trouble because the teacher was like, your child used the V word and everything. Oh. And then we had to explain that it's just a medical term. It's just a particular private part and everything. It's not a big deal. But it's good. It's important for young girls to understand that these, even though we use the word private part, these are normal terms. These are part of your body. Mm. It's not something to be ashamed of or to hide. And it's good to talk about it with your parents or your teachers and things like that. I think that's where it starts from for a lot of young girls. If you're confident in your body and you understand that what you have is not something that's shameful, something you have to hide all the time, you become more confident in your own sexual health and own medical health in general as well.
Which is why I think it's so important for us to have this conversation.
Yeah.
Because for me, I come from a background where we don't talk about our private parts. And in fact, when you ask questions, there's always this, oh, you'll know when you grow up. And you're like, how come I'll know when I grow up, right? But you never dare to ask. And there's a certain sort of reaction that you get from your parents when you ask, and then that tells you, okay, I shouldn't talk about it at all. No, I wanted to ask you as well, because I have a young daughter,
yeah,
and I want to sort of empower myself and know what to do when the time is right.
Yeah.
Is there a right time for us to start this relationship with a gynecologist?
Okay. Before we talk about just relationship with gynecologists, I think we need to have a relationship with the body itself, because from very early age, I think from age 2-3 years old, I already taught my children about being in control of their own bodies, to be aware of what is private, what can be touched by others, what cannot be touched by others, when they go to the toilet, who can help them, who can't. It starts there, where they are not told to be shameful, where they're not told to be fearful, but at the same time to be in control of themselves. Because we always hear about all these news stories about kids who are, you know, like molested and touched, and they didn't know that this was a problem. It starts off there. Give them confidence, give them a lot of freeway to talk to you about these things. After talking to them more freely at about age of 2 to 3, as they grow older, they'll get curious. They'll start asking questions. And it's very important to realize that this day and age group, like your daughter and mine as well, they've got lots of social media. all around them. They learn so much from, you know, like Facebook and Google and everything.
And TikTok.
And TikTok. Oh my God, the videos.
That is
Yeah. So it's like, after a while, I find myself redundant because they know more than I do, but sometimes they know the wrong things as well. So the important thing is never to make them feel shameful or feel embarrassed of asking, like, hey, I saw this on the video. Is this normal? Is this correct? Are we supposed to be able to, you know, talk about these things and all that? And let them know that it's fine. You know, like if there's something wrong, tell them, no, we don't always expose our wee-wees in the public and things like that. Or, you know, if you're worried about certain things about intercourse and, you know, you're curious about these things, talk to mama first, because we're the first line of defense. And then once they find that they are able to talk to you without being judged, that's very important, because nowadays a lot of the tweens, like my 10, 11 year olds, they already know so much that I didn't even know till I was like 18, and I'm a gynecologist. When they ask you questions, be very open. Don't let them feel ashamed, like, oh my gosh, I asked mama about this and now she's a bit upset, maybe I shouldn't talk about it anymore. Be open, be talking about them and all that. Later on, as they grow older, that's when you realize that they may need a gynecologist to step in. Maybe they get a bit active earlier, or they start getting curious, or they're worried. Like, I have young girls who are about 12, 13 years old with unusually shaped private parts. Let's just talk about that. Labia is a bit enlarged and things like that. And then, you know, they're a bit ashamed of themselves, so they feel shy going swimming with their classmates. And the mothers bring them in. And that's my job, to literally say, this looks normal. I'm not going to operate on you. You don't need anything. Or if I do think that it needs help, I'm like, good, you came to the right person. This is what we need to do. And then we go ahead and manage them accordingly. So that's something very important. It goes from young age all the way to older, where they're comfortable enough to tell the mom, like, mom, I think something's off. Like, all my classmates say they're looking like this, but I look a bit different. Something is off. That's when they come to the professionals and they feel better. And I think we talked about it yesterday, about how certain, like Asian parents, they don't talk too much about them, right? So the kids come in much later, like when they're pregnant. Where else, I have a lot of like the expat moms, they bring their kids when they're 13, 14 years old with lots of curiosity, questions about contraception and infections and all the other things, because they had that first contact and it's a very safe environment. Mom's there, the gynecologist there, I'm there, and we talk a bit more about what's important and what isn't. Later on, if they do get into trouble, or if they do encounter something that's a bit off, they're happy to come back to me on their own, or they drop me an email and things like that. So it's important that it starts young with the mom or anyone in the family who's a female family member, and then it grows from there.
I mean, you just mentioned that at when your kids are two or three, that you already start telling them, like, you know, boundaries and what's okay, what's not okay. Isn't that a bit too young?
No. Because that's when they start going to nursery.
Right.
And then, you know, it's like, I find that as a gynecologist, I feel responsible for every female around me and everything. And, you know, you hear about people who were abused when they were young. Or, you know, they compare themselves. Because even when they're 2 to 3, my kids were coming back from nursery and going, like, you know, the boys, they go to the different toilet and they pull down their pants, but we need to sit down. And they don't understand why. And so you have to explain those little things and that differences and how they don't have to be shy about it. And then I think it's important that if mom talks about these things, it's no longer a shy thing to do. Because I remember when I was a 5, 6 years old, a lot of my cousins, they used to call their private parts my shame. Like, you know, girls, that's your shame. You remember?
Yeah. Now that you mentioned, I think, like, when you, like, if you didn't, like, if you sit open and then shame.
Yeah. They don't do that to the boys. They don't do that to boys. The boys can sit this way and it's fine, right? But when the girls, you know, sit somewhere, oh, shame, cover. It's like, I remember that and it was very normal. But the thing is that this is something to be embarrassed about. You're not supposed to talk about it, not to mama, not to anything, because it's a very shameful thing. So that needs to be taken care of very early.
Yeah, because when you mentioned this, I now recall once having a conversation with one of my preschoolers teachers. And I think there were some parents who were a little bit upset or concerned, because there was just a lot of, like, this poo-poo, pee-pee talk in class. And then all the kids at that age, you know, we're talking about preschool, and they're, like, giggling and, like, you know. So when we encounter our kids behaving in this way, for example, like, what should we do?
Yeah, it's very common. It's like all the psychologists talk to you about this. It's like when they're 2 to 3 years old, it's the most funniest thing in the world to talk about poo-poo, BB in private and all that stuff. So the first thing is, of course, to address it and talk to them what exactly that private part is called. You can, if you want to and you don't feel comfortable, you can call it, you know, a different word. Or if not, you can just use the medical term and say what it is. Mm-hmm. And then you just say, this is what we use to pee, and that's it. And this is what we use to go to the toilet with, and we need to keep it clean, and we need to cover it up because we're not supposed to show it to everyone else except for grandma and mama or something like that. So it's fine to have that conversation. And they're joking about it, which means that, you know, it's something new and it's that's the curiosity coming in. And that's the nice opening for you guys to go in and start talking to the kids a little bit more. But they don't need to know about the birds and bees at that age at all.
Yeah.
But they do need to know that this is an area that you're supposed to cover, but it's normal, and we don't allow others to touch it except for, you know, certain select people. And then later on, we're going to talk a little bit more. So birds and the bees talks, I would say, honestly, maybe like 9 to 10, they start getting a bit more with the social media and all that. Then you talk a bit more about it, and depending on the child.
Would you say that this that once a girl starts having her period, that she should that's the best time to sort of inform them about, you know, sexual health and all that they need to know?
Yeah, for sure. I think because we need to explain to them. However, one of the things I always say is that before she even has the period, because there's no shock to a child, because nowadays they get precocious periods. So they used to be 13, 14, 15 when they used to get periods for the first time. Nowadays we have 10 and 11 year olds because the children are much more taller, have much more nutrition. And because their BMI is at the right stage, we're getting periods earlier and earlier and earlier. So I usually tell mums that if you feel that your child is developing a bit more faster, so one of the first things that young girls would get is breast development or, you know, armpit hair and things like that, that's already a sign that, you know, the secondary sexual characteristics are developing for the child, then I'll say start having the talk already. Like, look, you know, you're starting to get hair in the little places that you're supposed to talk. Or you're starting to get a bit more breasts, and now we need to have a training bra. What's going to happen next is your period, and this is what period's all about. And why do we have periods, and why do we not have periods? And that's the way in again. So I always talk about the way in, how to get in there. If we talk out of nowhere, the kids are going to be very suspicious. Like, what did I do? Why are they talking about it? You know, did she see me do something weird? Why am I something abnormal about me? But if there is a way in, it's usually looking at how the child is developing or what the child's interests are. Or they start talking about things like, oh, you know, my best friend got her period or something like that. You can start talking there and then already.
What can we say as a layman? Because obviously we are not medically trained. Like, how do we explain? Like, why do we get our periods? Why do I have breasts? And or even, when will I have breasts? You know.
Yes. Oh, that's like the number one question. I'm still asking my mom this, but she's like, soon, Dash, soon. So basically, when we're talking about sexual development, in the olden days, it was all about so that you can have babies. And that was all it was. It's like, you know, so that you can be reproductive and, you know, you can have babies and things like that. I think we can introduce the word hormones and how your hormones are different from the boys' hormones. And that's why, you know, boys develop differently and girls develop differently. And then, you know, when you have breasts, you know, some are small, some are big. You have to talk about the diversity very importantly, because a lot of girls, you know, when they look at social media, even the 13, 14-year-olds, I have girls coming in going like, I'm very small, what's wrong with me? And I'm like, there's nothing wrong. It's just normal development. So it's very important for the mother, because she's the first person who can actually like encounter this child's questions and everything, to let her know that these are all normal variants and it's fine. Some develop later, some develop earlier, it doesn't matter. And if the child still doesn't believe the mom, that's when you bring it to the doctor, and then I can give a little talk as well. And then when they ask about, like, why am I having a period? And we just say, good, that means that you're developing, you know, you're blossoming as a woman and you're becoming, you know, like someone who has a potential to have babies if you want, and as an adult. And if you don't want, that's fine as well. That's an important question to have as well, because otherwise every child is like, because I want grandchildren, and then they feel bad. So it's important to tell them that, you know, when you have your period, it might be painful, it might not be, and then this is the kind of equipment that you need to, not equipment, oh my gosh, no, like these are the products that you can use. And you know, there's this whole like bunch of people around you who've all had their period and were still alive and well, and that makes them reassured that they're not a freak and that there's nothing abnormal going on with them. So the main thing is that you're developing. That's why you have your period, and that's a good sign that you've got good hormones, you've got good nutrition, and things are going right.
I suppose with the talk about period, and now we are capable at this point to have babies and all that, comes the next part.
Yes, and that's the next question, right?
Right. So the next part is going to be about, you know, the whole sexual curiosity and, you know, what you, the sex talk that we have with the children. Like, how do we go about with that?
Yeah. So it depends on the child, honestly. Like, some kids are very shy. You don't have to have that talk. Don't have to force it on them. You know, when they're ready, they will approach you. Or if you feel that the child is getting very curious on the internet, you know, like, always keep an eye on the child. I always believe until the age of 18, keep an eye on what they're watching on social media. I think we have every right as parents to keep an eye on them. So if the child is getting a bit more curious, or they are starting going out with friends, or if they're starting to date and all that, that's the best time to kind of like have a earlier conversation about all these things. And then when they're ready to open up, they will. So we don't have to force them at all.
Like, when do you think it's the right age to have a boyfriend?
If my children are watching this, it's 25. No. Honestly, it depends on the child again.
I was told 21.
I think what matters is the child's maturity. That's so important. And the openness between the parent and child. Because if the child is not very mature and there is no open communication between the child and the parent, these are the children who could be abused. These are children could be taken advantage of because they're not mature enough to handle all these emotions. They don't know how to say no. They don't feel that they're in control. At the same time, they don't have an open communication with their parents. They get in trouble. The child is mature. She's confident in her being. And since the age of 2 or 3, she's been taught by her parents that, you know, these are normal things to happen. You know, these are part of your own body and you have your own independence, to autonomy, sorry, to say no when you don't want something to be done. You're fine. You don't have to worry about the kid. She's probably just going to go out for a movie and come back and it'll be absolutely fine. And then if she ever gets in trouble, or if she feels a bit curious, or she's a bit concerned, if there's an open line of communication, she'll come to you. She'll say, "Mama, you know, I didn't want to do this and I was asked to. What do I do?" Then you have your adult conversation with her. So those two things have to happen. The child has to be mature and confident in her own well-being, and she has to have an open line of communication with the adults who are taking care of her. You won't get in trouble.
I guess for me, like, when my mom or my parents telling me that I can only date when I'm 21, I'm not allowed to have a boyfriend. I think the biggest concern that we have for our daughters is the fact that they might get pregnant. That seems to be the biggest reason why, you know, we are asking our daughters to, you know, not have a boyfriend till they're 25. Is that the only thing that we should be worried about?
No, it's not just pregnancy. It's their own well-being in general. It's infections. It's other things. It's getting their heart broken. If they're not emotionally ready to handle a relationship or the breaking up of the relationship, it might affect their studies and, you know, eventually their whole, you know, life story as well. So it's multifactorial. And I feel that, you know, we need to let them know about these things as well. Like, if you find that your child is dating and she's 16, 17 years old, you need to have the convo. Like, are you ready to handle if you guys break up? Okay, that's great. Do you know that if you start getting active, you know, it'd be good to know about it? Because there is not just pregnancy, there's infections, there's all the other issues that can happen.
Hang on. Did you just say you want to know if your child is...
Yeah, I'm hoping that they don't. I'm hoping that they wait till they're 21. But I want to know if they are. Because if they get in trouble, I want to be there to help them if something needs to be done. The last thing you want is for the child to go and get the help of a fellow teenager or an adult who can't help them very well.
Or worse, Google.
Like, I think it's better that you have the open line of communication. Let them know, because everyone has different cultures, different expectations. We're Catholic, so we're just like, no, until you're 35. No, you know, it's literally like...
You just push back 10 years again.
Push back another 10 years because of that. So it's like every culture is different. Every, you know, household is different and everything. Yeah. So you can always let them know what you your expectations are, what you, maybe not expectations, that's a bit harsh, your hopes are. I really hope that you wait. I really hope that when you're mature enough and your studies are not that important, like you've already gone to university and you're fine, and you're mature enough that I feel that you're ready to handle relationship, that's the time they choose, then they'll respect you, because then they go like, okay, she means well. It's not a dictatorship. It's more of like, she's concerned of all these things. And I agree with her. I need to maybe finish my whatever before I start having a relationship. And they will listen to you. And it's always about pregnancy, but it's never always pregnancy. There's so many other things that you worry about as well.
Let's talk about these other things that we should be worried about.
Yeah. Okay. So basically, you know, I'm sure you've heard of STDs and everything. You know, we always say, okay, if you wear condoms, then, you know, you will not get anything. But that's not true, because teenagers and young adults may not always be, you know, careful. So one slip up and you might have an infection that lasts a lifetime. There are many infections that can be cured for sure, but there are many infections that stay with you for a long time, like chlamydia. Whatever age you get it, a lot of times it doesn't leave your body completely. It can affect your reproductive organs and leave you infertile.
Oh.
And then because it blocks your tubes and goes off if it's not treated. So if you have a young girl who's 21, had chlamydia, didn't know about it, left it in her system for many years without any treatment, it can block her tubes and she becomes infertile. So these are things that people don't really talk about or are aware of. And HIV, of course, is permanent as well. I mean, of course, we've got lots of medication to treat it and keep it under control, but the best way is not to get it in the first place. There are other viruses like HPV, you know, which can cause cervical cancer, and that can't even be protected by condoms. It's like, that is like, it's by any kind of intimate contact, and the moment you get contact with it, then you have a chance of getting issues in the future. So these are things that you have to be aware of. So rather than following my advice or telling my girls boys are gross, it's more of like, just be careful, be aware of what's out there. It's not just pregnancy that you have to worry about. And as long as that's there, then they're more aware of what they need to worry about.
So for the longest time, I used to be really terrified of this cervical cancer. But then I feel like, you know, we need to learn more about it and to learn more. And a lot of people are telling me also like, oh, you know, even my nutritionist is telling me like, oh, no, it's not so scary. You know, nowadays you can prevent it. So let's talk a little bit about, because you mentioned HPV causing cervical cancer. Let's talk a little bit about HPV and actually what is it? And can we tell? Like, are there any signs? Because we know like with sexually transmitted diseases, it comes off a little bit more obvious, right? Like you have warts and what are the symptoms that you can see, spot? Yeah.
So in most STDs, you know, patients talk about discharges, itchiness, discomfort, lumps and bumps and all that. So we immediately know something's off. Then we do the right test and we'll find out what's going on. The thing about HPV is that there's also a couple of them which cause genital warts as well. So there are different kinds of diseases that HPV can cause. So the human papillomavirus, if it's a type 6 or 11, it causes those, you know, the genital warts that we talk about. It can also cause the simple ones, like, you know, the little plantar warts that some people have on their fingers, on their toes. That's also HPV as well. So,
So not just in your private areas.
Not just in your private area. So HPV, for example, you know, if you're sharing shoes with strangers all the time, like if you go scuba diving or to the gym and you're sharing those rubber shoes that are wet and moist, there's a chance that you can pick up HPV just from that intimate skin contact. Is the one way that HPV is spread. So it's never just by intercourse. Just by touching someone who has a direct lesion, it can come to you. But the only problem is that that's the only time when you can see it. Otherwise, you don't see it. It's very asymptomatic. 80% of sexually active adults have HPV. But it's not necessarily the high-risk one. So you don't have to worry that, oh my gosh, now I'm going to get cervical cancer and things like that. So there are over 100 types. So type 16 and type 18, they account for cervical cancer-causing viruses. And then these are the ones that we want to protect our young girls against. And so that's why nowadays, you know, we're getting all these vaccinations for the young girls and everything to help them.
How does this vaccine work?
It's basically a protein that looks just like the outside part of the virus. If you're protected and you have antibodies to protect you against HPV, then you have a lower chance of having that long-term in your body as well. However, it's very important that vaccination is not just it. It's important to keep screening as well, because it's not like a 100% protective thing. Mm. It's important to see your very friendly gynecologist and get your pap smears.
Okay.
So, have you done your pap smear, Joanne?
Yes, I have. Before we go into pap smear, I wanted to ask this also. At what age should we bring our girls in for this vaccination?
Yes. So, usually now in Singapore, the schools are starting to vaccinate them at age 13 to 14 years old. Mm. And that's one of the things I like to talk about, is that this is a time where you can have the next conversation. You know, this is another outlet where you can like talk to the kid, like, why am I vaccinating you against a virus? What's it going to cause to you? Mm. And what's it going to protect you? And again, talk about body autonomy and protection and how you are in control of everything. Mm. So the age group will be from 9 to about 14, 15 years of age. Mm. That's the best vital time before they become active and before the immunity becomes a bit more waning in nature. I think that's the best age.
And what about those people who feel that, you know, I'm not for vaccines, I will just do screenings and see how that goes. You know, I don't want to take a vaccine and put stuff in. What is your
take? We have to respect them. Oh, right. It's like, you know, like, after all, it's like it's my body, my choice kind of thing, right? Get it from the Americans. So they are allowed to choose that. But what I always explain to patients is this: we finally have a vaccine, or actually three different types of vaccines, that can protect against a certain kind of cancer that attacks a lot of women. So it's useful. And the fact that over 80% of women can have HPV, that's a large number. So because of that, I would advocate for, you know, pushing for the vaccination of everyone, you know, to protect themselves, and then just keep going from there.
So unlike the COVID vaccine, which a lot of people are sort of thinking that, you know, it's so quick, you know, the HPV vaccine has actually gone through
lots
years
of studies. But along with screening, which is very important still, you still need to screen.
Which is pap smears.
So you still need to do pap smears, and then you can also, every 5 years, you can do your HPV test as well. Along with that, I think because of the vaccine, the rate has gone down so much. Mm. And in countries where they've started vaccinating the young students in school, so it became part of the school policy, because, you know, in the long term, these women, they were reproductive, they had kids and everything. Thankfully, now in Singapore, we've also started to vaccinate the young ones at the age of 13 and 14. Mm. And hopefully that will also bring another exponential decrease in cervical cancer rates in Singapore as well.
I've also read some material saying that if we have HPV, it's very likely that our sexual partners also have HPV. So how can we have, like, involve the men in this conversation?
Yes. So they too should be protected, because they too can develop things like anal cancer. So it's very important that the boys also get protected as well.
Mm. Does it mean that once we get the vaccine that we will not get HPV?
Nah. Yeah, they always ask me that. So the thing is, no, unfortunately. So remember, there are over 100 different types. Mm. So there are two major types, type 16 and 18, which cause most of cervical cancer. And then there are major ones that cause almost like 95% of cervical cancers as well. As long as you're active and you're exposed, it's still possible to get cervical cancer. So it's important to keep screening all the way. What's good is that now that we can swap you for HPV and look at the types, if you don't have the high risk ones, you can do your pap smears every 5 years. If you do have the high risk ones, then the gynecologist may say, maybe let's do it every year and screen you every year to keep an eye on stuff. But you do not let go of it all the way until maybe the age of 65, and then after that you should be all right.
How long does it take for this HPV to develop into like a full-blown cancer?
Yes. Oh, yeah, so nothing to worry about. Again, because you don't know that you got it, because, you know, it's asymptomatic. Sometimes patients may not know that they have HPV. Mm. So that's the purpose of screening, is to check for early changes. And these changes are not cancer at all. These are just early changes in cells that tells the gynecologist that, hey, there's a HPV that's going rogue. It's starting to cause changes in the cervix. We need to get in there and treat it so that it doesn't develop. Mm. And by treatment, we're talking about zapping that area or taking out a small area of the tissue and everything, so that the patient never develops cervical cancer. Mm. And one thing that we always tell patients is this: as long as you're screening regularly and according to the schedule that your gynae puts you on, touch wood, have never seen a patient develop cancer because there is a long time, around 10 years or even longer, before you actually develop cervical cancer signs and symptoms and everything. Mm. So if we can catch you early, we can treat you, and there is no way you'll end up with that.
When you mean the treatments, does it affect your, you know, childbearing abilities, or does it cause any changes to you? Right. Yeah.
Depending on where we find. So for example, we have these things called CIN1, 2 or 3. These are what precursors to cancer, but they're not cancer. It's just pre-changes that can be happening because of HPV. So if I see someone with CIN1, I'll just say, look, you know, amp up. This is where my holistic bit comes in. You know, like amp up your vitamin C's, your probiotics. You know, do yoga, stop swimming, stop smoking. Not swimming, you can swim. Stop smoking. But it's not always. Like, don't get pregnant. It's more important. And then, you know, those kind of things can help to improve your immunity. Mm. And then by doing that, maybe that will reduce the chances of HPV progressing further. If they develop CIN2 or 3, again, these are not cancers, just pre-changes, then we do this thing called a leap cone biopsy, which is where we go to the neck of the womb and we do this tiny little surgery to remove a very small area of the cervix. We take it out and then that's it. All the cells leaving behind are normal, healthy. Mm. And then she's back to square one. Then we just keep an eye on her. Mm. Next.
So can still have babies and give birth. And it doesn't, you don't pass it on to your child as well.
There are very rare times where the mother has an active genital warts. Mm. So if you have genital warts, which is due to HPV type 6 and 11, then you've got these little lumps and bumps, your obstetrician will know about it. She will see it and go like, look, we're not going to have a vaginal birth. Because if you do that, the HPV will directly go into the baby and it can develop in their oral pharynx area. So, you know, the vocal cord area and all that stuff, it can have HPV. And then the baby can't swallow and then they have a lot of issues. So that's a very serious but very rare papillomatosis thing that we call. Mm. But it doesn't happen often. If you don't have an active lesion, you can have a vaginal birth without any problem at all.
Mm. So, you know, since you mentioned that 80% of us have got HPV, and very likely that we have it and we don't, is it something to be ashamed of?
No. 80% of us be shame. You don't have to be ashamed for sure, because it's something that happens all the time. What's important is that you get the right screening, the right monitoring, and as long as you know, you don't have any active lesions and all that, you don't need treatment. It's when you start having lesions that's when, you know, the gynecologist will get in and start doing surgeries and things like that. And it should be fine, and you'll never ever pass it to your babies unless you have an active lesion due to genital herpes. Genital HPV.
Okay, so you mentioned just now that the baby might even get it in the throat. So, you know, people laugh, like, but there's just been like a lot of teasing, or not teasing, I don't even know if that's the right way.
I know what you're going for.
We're talking about Michael Douglas here, you know. So what is the truth? I mean,
is he gonna sue me?
Because, you know, I mean, okay, so, we want to be informed here. We don't want to be misinformed. Is it because he had oral sex, or you know, he could have caught it?
So that's all hearsay.
Yeah,
Joanne.
Okay.
So, but in general, we do know that if you get HPV, and it's in your esophageal area, and it's one of those high risk ones, there is a potential for it to develop into esophageal cancer, and it's due to the virus. And that's how it, you know, like progresses form and all that. Whether, you know, like, one person's esophageal cancer due to HPV or not, we don't know, because esophageal cancer has so many other reasons as well. Like, you can have a gastric issue or reflux that causes a lot of acidity, and that causes esophageal cancer as well. But it could also be due to HPV as well. Mm. So the reason why we always try to talk about, you know, like the non-cervical cancer stuff about HPV is that it affects both genders. That's the main take home that I want to tell, is that we don't know whether, you know, like, who will develop it, who will not, but we do know that she is not the only one who's going to be affected by it. So if he is protected too, that would be an amazing thing. And if all mums could hear this story and know that, you know, I want to protect my son, and I also want to protect my son's future partners as well, it'll be the right thing to do to help them all. And that's what I'm hoping for.
So how best can we have this conversation with our kids then? Like, just before we, let's say we want to take them for the vaccination, how do we talk to them about it?
So again, it started from the age of two, and then we're having this conversation, we're talking about all these things, and the funny go like, you know, nowadays in P5, that's when they have the first sexual education talk by the government and everything, right?
Okay.
So you can start with that. And then you say that this is to protect you against a very dangerous disease called cancer. Not many children know about it. They heard about it, but they don't know what it is because it usually affects older people in their 90s and all that. So you tell them that this is a cancer that can affect young women and young men as well. And we can protect you or give you a high chance of not developing it into cancer. And then during that time, we can also talk about how, you know, pregnancy is not the only thing you worry about in sexual health, and that how other infections can also be spread by, you know, sexual intercourse, and how, you know, not just the pill, you need condoms as well to protect you. And unfortunately, this particular virus, it's not protected by the condom, like not completely, because as long as any kind of skin contact, it can affect you. And that's why before they become active, we're going to give this to you. There are questions about, okay, we do this, they're going to be so active the next day. Like you give it to a 9-year-old and by the 10 years old, she's out there and like, you know, flourishing. But no, no study has shown that to happen at all. In fact, the children feel more safe. They feel like, you know, the adults around them are protecting them against something that's dangerous. The trust is built in that way as well. And they also feel more reassured, like, okay, now I'm just this more safer in this world because of this injection. And my mom's had it, my dad's had it, and now I'm having it. So it becomes more reassuring.
Okay, I think we've covered quite a bit. Is there anything that I didn't manage to sort of ask you, you know, that you can share either from your sort of personal encounters with your patients or some of the questions that they may have asked you that I haven't thought of? That
they always ask about cost, like protection and everything. I really think, you know, like if it was covered by the government, it would be amazing. So I think that's the main thing that I'm hoping for nowadays as well, so that my patients don't have to worry about cost. Because if it's a, such a small cost compared to the cost of treating cervical cancer or a baby that's affected by a mum who had genital warts, it's so low compared to that. And if we could cover across the board for whatever choice the patient makes, that'll be very vital.
Well, I also wanted to sort of, because I just remembered that, you know, to talk a little bit about how a pap smear procedure is like for those who are maybe uncomfortable, you know, bearing your legs open to a gynecologist.
If it's done right, Stuart, if it's done right, it's so painless, it's nothing. It's like a walk in the park. A dodgy kind of walk in the park. But honestly, it's nothing. Because the main thing is that the gynecologist's job is to put you at ease and make you feel comfortable. And then we use this device called the speculum, which is this very tiny little thing, the size of like two thumbs kind of thing, to insert into the vagina. We have a look at the cervix, and then we just do a quick couple of brushes, and that's it. It takes less than a minute. But it's very, very simple to do. It's like an ART for the vajayjay. That's what it's like.
Oh, yes, that's
like we should advertise it this way. ART for the vajayjay, and that's the way to go.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Darsh, for making this so entertaining and so lighthearted. And I believe that my listeners would definitely benefit from this, knowing that there's the vaccine that they can take, knowing that there's screening that they can do, and how cervical cancer is really not that scary if you actually take the right steps.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Dr. Darsh. I hope you found my conversation with Dr. Darsh informative. Be sure to follow and subscribe to the podcast on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review and share it with your friends. You can also find a video version of this podcast with some bonus content over at my brand new YouTube channel, Too Happy Media. What Do I Know is brought to you by my friends from Zodapop by Zirup Media. You can also find me on my Instagram at Joanne Pei, that's JoAnnePeh. And I'll see you in my next episode. Thank you so much for listening. Bye.
This was the Zodapop podcast.